our speaker is Justin White, who's in public health in the health HSPA.
Yeah.
Health Services Policy Analysis. Okay. And he's been associated with demography for a long time. He's on the kind of a training grant, and he's been working on his dissertation and a project on in Thailand on getting people to stop smoking, and with broader implications for changing health-related behavior. And so we're looking forward to hearing.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And so, as Ron said, I'm going to present some findings from, this is a pilot study that tries to investigate if smoking cessation services can be enhanced using behavioral economics theory, using financial commitment and monetary incentives. And it's trying to provide smoking cessation services in rural communities in a part of central Thailand. And this is very much still ongoing work, and so I definitely appreciate your feedback, and especially if you have suggestions about how I can make this more relevant for a demography audience. So feel free to chime in anytime. So this is a collaboration between UC Berkeley and Sinakrien Lirot University in Thailand. Will, who's here today, is the PI on the project. And it was funded by a couple pilot grants through CEDA and the Berkeley Top Center, as well as my time was funded through the training grant. So I'd like to thank everyone in the room who kind of helped to make this project possible. So just diving right in. First, let me kind of just give you the summary, the nuts and bolts of what I'm talking about, just to kind of orient you to it. So this was an intervention in central Thailand where we offered smokers a three-month intervention that we called team commitment contracts. And so it has two parts. So the first part is where we offered people a savings account that the smoker would keep only if he quit smoking successfully. And that was supposed to motivate him to maintain self-control. And the second part, We formed teams of two smokers, and we offered a cash bonus if both smokers quit. And so there's a couple of different aspects to this that I'll get into a bit later. So this was compared to just offering counseling and education for smoking cessation from nurses. That was what the control group received. And in total, about 10% of smokers in the area signed up for this intervention. And you can see the quit rate, so it was 44% in the treatment group, 19% in the control group, so this is a pretty large 25 percentage point treatment effect, and we can dive into kind of what's underlying that a little bit later. And the cost per quitter was about $450, controlling for differences in purchasing power across countries, so that's kind of denominated in US dollars, and that is fairly cost effective, as I'll show you, compared to other interventions. So, just to kind of motivate the health side of this, yeah.
So just to clarify, the savings account, is that money that the smoker puts in it originally, or did you guys?
Yes, so the smoker gives money up front, and so the person's trying to kind of bind themselves to quit smoking by using this kind of monetary incentive. So this is global mortality that's attributable to tobacco based on demographic projections, and you can see that this is going from 2000 to 2030, and by 2030, there's, according to this, supposed to be 8 million deaths that are attributable to tobacco, so that's growing over time and quite considerable, and it's kind of equally proportioned between deaths from cancer, cardiovascular disease, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is kind of bronchitis and emphysema. So, so breaking it out by the country income level, you can see that most of these deaths are actually occurring in middle and low income countries. And you see that in high income countries, that this is expected to be fairly stable over time, whereas in low and middle income countries, this is rising. I should note that so there's obviously the normal data quality issues associated with these projections. These are not my projections, they're taken from Matthews and Lonker. But also, these are based on data that's a decade old, and they don't take into account the fact that there's been a lot of regulation of tobacco use over the last decade. And that's in part because the World Health Organization has passed this a tobacco control treaty that the majority of the world's population falls under. And so many countries have been regulating tobacco, and I haven't found any projections that kind of update these numbers. Yes.
I would say for a demographic audience, or any audience, it would be a lot more useful to have these on a per person or age standardized or something, because of course the population of many countries is going to be stable or declining and so on and so forth.
Okay, thanks. This is just showing deaths that are attributed to various risk factors, and you can see tobacco use is second from the bottom, and this is based on the Global Burden of Disease Project data from 2004, and tobacco is the second leading risk factor according to their projection or their analysis. And most of the deaths, which is consistent with what we saw, is falling within middle-income countries, and specifically within China, where about one out of three smokers live. And so just to kind of put in perspective before I jump into my study. So looking at the rate of smoking in Thailand, this is daily smokers, and Thailand is really known for being fairly aggressive in regulating tobacco, and is kind of viewed by other countries as being a regional and a global leader in tobacco control. And it's been heavily regulating tobacco for about 20 years now. In part, the result of that is that smoking prevalence has declined since 1990. You can see there's a bit of an uptick recently, but that could be because that's from the latest data point is from a different survey. So it's thought that male prevalence right now is about 40%, and female prevalence is about 5%. So this is mostly men who are going to be in my study, and that this is the main reason why. And this kind of motivates why I chose Thailand, specifically because my intervention really relies on smokers who have some sort of existing desire to quit. And Thailand has a particularly high demand for quitting. And in addition, these other countries in Asia have been regulating tobacco quite a bit in recent years, but they're still quite a ways behind Thailand in terms of both in terms of smoking prevalence and in terms of regulations. And the hope is that this evidence could possibly carry over to these other countries in 5 or 10 years once that there's a kind of bigger pool of potential quitters there. So here I've broken out the smoking prevalence by age group as well as by urbanicity. And so the blue line is in rural areas, and you can see that in rural areas there's higher smoking rates for all adult age groups relative to the urban areas in red. Globally, I haven't really been able to find very good estimates on a country-by-country basis of urban versus rural smoking rates, but I did find that WHO does estimate that kind of global smoking prevalence in rural areas is slightly higher than urban areas. So this pattern is probably not that uncommon.
Could that be the result of more effective campaigning in urban areas, or do you think that's underlying trends since?
So I think part of it, which I'm going to get to in the next slide, is that I do think it's at least in part due to the availability of smoking treatment services, which are really not very readily available in rural areas. In part, this could in Thailand, this is could be a cohort effect. It certainly could be because campaigns, advertising campaigns that are anti-smoking message campaigns are certainly more prominent in urban areas. So I think it's a really mixture of things going on there. So there's three main approaches according to treatment guidelines for treating tobacco. So there's professional counseling, nicotine replacement therapy, which includes the patch and nicotine gum, etc. And then there's prescription drugs. There's a few of those. And all of these have been proven through clinical trials to be efficacious, although recently there has been some kind of quarreling among tobacco control researchers about kind of the real-world effectiveness of these approaches. But for the main issue with these is that they're kind of difficult to provide in resource-constrained settings, in particular in developing countries and even more specifically in rural areas of developing countries. So there's a lack of medical professionals, especially in rural areas. There's limited access to facilities. And a key barrier is the cost. And I'm going to get to that a little bit later. But relative to the income of the local population, these treatments are quite expensive. And if the government is paying for them, it's a fairly big drag on the government budget. So I guess the main point is that even though you know the majority of the world's smokers are living in rural areas, there's really a lack of treatment options for them. And so that's kind of where I hope my study fits in. So I'm not going to dive in. I'm going to kind of just give you a broad outline of the theory just to give you a very kind of superficial sense of the model. But I'll try to at least motivate it a little bit. So this all comes from behavioral economics, which is a field that kind of combines elements of psychology and economics and is, you know, all the rage these days. And so economists, or behavioral economists at least, oftentimes conceptualize addiction as a self-control problem. And so what they mean by that is that people oftentimes have goals for themselves that they set that they're unable to follow through on, in part because they privilege kind of present costs and benefits over future costs and benefits. And so, for example, hypothetical situation, let's say you're sitting in a demography brown bag and somebody puts a plate of cookies in front of you. So you have these long-term health goals that you want to achieve, you want to eat a healthy diet, but as soon as somebody puts the plate in front of you, you're obviously tempted to eat it, and you know, oftentimes you will kind of you know, throw your long-term health goals aside and scarf down the cookies. So that's essentially the intuition behind the self-control problem. And there's a lot of evidence that this does apply to tobacco use. Just to give you one example, so for instance, it's very common for smokers to require multiple quit attempts before they succeed. And quit attempts can be very costly psychologically. It's a very painful process. And if somebody was really time consistent and following through on their long-run preferences, it's kind of unlikely that they would keep cycling on and off. And so the specific, now I'll just show you quickly kind of the model that we have in mind. So the standard model for economics is where you have some lifetime utility that's a function of your present utility at time that's little t, as well as your future utility that's discounted to the present by some discount factor delta. And so baked into this formula is the idea that people have these long-run preferences that are consistent over time. And there's this dynamic consistency is what this formula implies. And so behavioral economists have kind of just tweaked this model a small amount that has real large implications in different model predictions. And so in particular, they've added this beta term, which discounts or kind of weights the present much more heavily than the future in all future periods. And so behavioral economists often think of this as there's multiple selves. And so there's a present self, there's a self tomorrow, and there's a self the day after tomorrow, and so on. And this time inconsistency comes from the fact that the present self has different preferences relative to these future selves. And this creates some sort of a bias in favor of the present self, because that present self is kind of just thinking about behaving impulsively and thinking about his own welfare. And this present self can impose negative externalities, or what's called internalities, on these future selves. And so this can kind of hurt long-run welfare, which is why economists are really interested in this idea. There has been one estimate of this present bias among smokers, which finds that on average, this beta parameter it falls within 0.7 and 0.9. And this model, you'll notice that if beta equals 1, it reduces down to the standard model. And so if you can estimate beta, then you can generate some sort of some test between the standard model and this behavioral model.
Aren't there some set of discount rates that would be the same as any beta? How can you really...
Yeah, and so I guess I would possibly compare it to instrumental variables in terms of finding some sort of clever solution to this problem, where it's really hard to tease apart this kind of short-run discount factor from a long-run discount factor. And so, for instance, the smoking study I think they use differences in terms of regional price variation due to commodity prices, and then longer run discount factors due to taxation. And so you have to kind of tease apart. And it's very tricky to do. It hasn't been done with much success, but there's a lot of people out there currently trying to estimate this parameter. And a key distinction that's drawn is between sophisticated smoker, or not smokers, sophisticated agents who know that they have some self-control problem, and naive people who are not aware that they have a self-control problem. And it's thought that these different kind of types of agents behave differently. The main one that I'm going to point you to is the fact that sophisticated agents are likely to search for some sort of commitment devices. And so, for example, going back to this cookie example, so perhaps you would walk into the room and you'd try to not sit near the cookie plate, or perhaps you make a promise to yourself ahead of time that I'm not going to eat that cookie. And so there's lots of ways that people try to commit themselves and go to the cookies, soften them up a little bit. So anyway, those are soft commitments that are not binding. But economists have kind of seized on this idea to try to find kind of harder commitments that bind a person to maintain self-control. And in particular, they've come up with agreements whereby somebody pays a penalty of some sort if they do not succeed in achieving their goal. And these are voluntary, of course. And oftentimes this is a financial penalty, us being economists. And in practice, this would work that somebody kind of maybe saves money in some sort of designated savings account, and if you don't achieve your goal, then you forfeit that money. That's kind of a common approach. This is a hot topic. There's a kind of fast-growing body of evidence about with different applications. And most of these do find that these commitment contracts are fairly successful. The one counterexample is with weight loss that at least this study did not find that over the long run that there was an improvement. People kind of lost the weight and then gained it back as soon as the commitment contract ended. So that as I'll talk about it later, is obviously a concern for my intervention as well. So at any rate, I'm really interested in smoking cessation. There's been one study that looks at these commitment contracts from smoking cessation using a randomized controlled trial. This was called the CARES trial, which took place in the Philippines. And the way it worked was that in the treatment group, it's similar to kind of what I said before, you get basically a piggy bank, people deposit money in the piggy bank, and then some deposit collector came and took that money on a weekly basis, and then the person had to quit smoking within 6 months in order to get that money back. And then that was compared to just getting simple literature from a pamphlet or brochure. And so 11% of people signed up for this contract, which is very similar on part of kind of what I found. And users really were using this these savings accounts fairly intensively. 20% of monthly income is quite substantial. And then they followed up with these people. It was a surprise follow-up 6 months after the deposits ended. And what they found was that there was an increase in long-run quits by 3.5 percentage points. However, this is over a very low baseline of only 8 percentage points, and so this is kind of moderately effective. But there's still probably room for improvement. And yeah, Aaron?
So maybe I missed this, but how do we know if someone quits? We can't rely on their self-reports if 20% of their income's at stake. Is someone assigned to monitor them?
So in this study and in my study, what was used was urine tests to biochemically verify. And so the urine test can detect if you have nicotine or cotinine, which is similar to nicotine in your system. So it is important, though, to have some sort of verification, most likely. Otherwise, there's obviously ample room to game the system.
And what about, there must be extremely strong self-selection into those who are willing to take on such a potentially costly plan. And so how is that dealt with?
So I would argue that that's actually a potential advantage of this approach. And so, as I referred to earlier, I kind of combine incentives with this commitment contract. And I think that does select out those people who perhaps aren't motivated and actually helps to target the intervention to those people who might best benefit from those incentives. Otherwise, you might be more likely to kind of just have people who are going to relapse anyway or who aren't necessarily totally committed. And so there's definitely a selection issue going on here. And that's why I referred to earlier that in Thailand there really is this pool of people who are interested in quitting. In any given year, like half of smokers are trying to quit. But it is a very important issue that you can't just kind of expect this to all of a sudden kind of be workable for the entire population. So.
But in comparing the outcomes between people who take this up and people who don't, if that's really a self-choice, then I would think it would be hard to know whether to attribute differences in success to program or to the, I wouldn't want to do it unless I were pretty damn sure I could do it.
Right. So in this trial, what they did was that this is analyzed on an intention to treat basis, which means that basically anybody who didn't, so they offered this contract to a bunch of people that even if the person didn't take it up, and they're still included in the analysis. And so that's how they got around it. I'll explain a bit later. My approach is a bit different. Does that kind of get it? And so, as I said, this is kind of moderately effective. One issue is that 66% of those people who tried these contracts still failed. So even though there's an increase, there's still a lot of people who are not succeeding. And so one possible reason is that the same self-control problem that leads people to not be able to quit in the first place leads them to not necessarily commit enough money into their savings account. And so they're not necessarily kind of committing to a level that's going to motivate them to quit. And so there could be this under-commitment problem, which is kind of inherently in this intervention. And so that was kind of the motivation for my team commitment idea, was to try to see how we can kind of strengthen the commitment. And what we came up with was trying to combine financial commitment with a social commitment of sorts. And so social commitment and social pressure, these kind of capture a whole range of concepts. But obviously social pressure has been known about, going back 50 years at least, if not much, much farther. And I'm just going to highlight, there is a big literature on this, so I'm just going to highlight two examples of this. So first of all, Cast and colleagues, they looked at informal savings groups where they had people publicly kind of make public announcements, proclamations about a savings goal. And then they met at subsequent meetings, they would follow up with them and try to see if they had achieved their goals. And so in this sense, this gets at peer monitoring as well as an accountability system to try to see if people are actually achieving their goals. And what they found was this kind of soft verbal commitment was good enough to raise people's quit rate, their savings rates by 3.5-fold. And so this was a huge, huge increase. I just want to demonstrate that peer monitoring can be a very powerful incentive to motivate people. And if you're familiar with rotating savings and credit associations that are very common in the developing world, those also some think through a similar mechanism. Another example is team incentives for exercise, and this is very similar to my idea, is that this group of researchers, this was with undergrads, they were trying to get them to go to the gym more often, so they paired them up, and they offered an incentive to both of them if they achieved their goal, went to the gym a certain number of times. And what they found was that these team incentives were as effective. So team incentives are the same amount as individual incentives. The team incentives were as effective, even though by their nature, these team incentives, at least in expected value terms, are less valuable. Because obviously your partners, there's some probability that the partner's going to fail. And so the team incentives aren't as kind of valuable in financial terms, but there's this social component that makes up for it. So, and that's also kind of what I'm trying to tap into. So the other thing I want to mention is that I'm not the first one to use monetary incentives to try to promote health behavior change. And there's a ton of different approaches. I mentioned sin taxes, conditional cash transfers, there's individual payments to tell people to change behavior. And on the whole, these have been fairly effective, although it depends on the context, depends on the case. Although for the case of smoking cessation, the evidence is decidedly more mixed in that there has been a lot of examples where people provide financial incentives, people quit, and then as soon as the incentives are removed, people relapse. And so that's a big concern. And so there hasn't really been much success with just paying people to quit. And I think what I was discussing with Ron earlier is that this approach using commitment contracts inherently is kind of selecting out those people who I think are most probably most able to benefit from the incentives. And so in that sense, I do want to distinguish between simply paying people to quit and using this commitment contract approach. So when you're paying people to, for any reason related to health behavior, there's a lot of concerns. I just want to just quickly name them. So one is in terms of intrinsic motivation. So people might feel that their autonomy is being undermined when you pay them to do something. As soon as you remove the incentives, that could alter their intrinsic motivation. So that's one concern. As I mentioned before, there's this issue about relapse or recidivism after the incentives end. And finally, cash can be coercive. And so in this project, we had a lot of discussion about trying to find an incentive amount, and also through pilot testing, that would motivate without coercing. And hopefully, we had struck the right balance with that. So getting to the specific study design, I kind of talked about the intervention already, but this has a commitment contract where people were depositing money with a community health worker. And so it's important to recognize that this was all occurring at the community level. And I think that probably did go a long way in terms of increasing participation in the study. So people were depositing money with a community health worker for 10 weeks. And they were also eligible for up to $10 in a matching contribution. So there was a small individual incentive for quitting. And then on top of it, we formed teams. So there were two options. So people could choose a teammate. If they had somebody in mind, or if they didn't have a teammate, then at enrollment, we randomly assigned a teammate, someone from the same village and from the same gender. And then if both of those members of the team quit, they got a $40 bonus. And I should also mention that the commitment contract had about $1.50 required deposit at enrollment. So it was a much smaller deposit compared to the bonus. However, if somebody thinks that they have a 50% chance of quitting and their partner has a 50% chance of quitting, then it's only an expected value term, that's only a $10 bonus. And so it's not as much as it might first seem. And there are a bunch of potential pathways through which this intervention is operating, through the deposits, there's social pressure, social support, reminders, this bonus. And so kind of where I'm going to be going with this is trying to figure out which of these is most important. And I'm just going to be able to touch on that, the issue about causal mechanisms today, but it's something that we will be focusing on a lot later. So the main aims for this was, first, is this feasible? Second, is this effective relative to counseling and education? And third, what are the causal mechanisms? So it took place in Nakhon Nayok province, which is just outside of Bangkok. It's six sub-districts. And we targeted 42 villages, which have about 500 people. Median household income, just to give you a sense, is about $10 per day. And they are fairly rural villages. The majority of people of households in these villages are dedicated to farming and agriculture. And it included both Buddhist and Muslim villages and individuals. And some of them were a bit more rural than others, so there is a little bit of variation there. And just to get to the specific design, so in order to figure out kind of what our take-up was, what our participation levels were, we first had the community health workers try to just do a census, basically, of all the smokers within their assigned block. So within each village in Thailand, there are community health workers, and each community health worker is already assigned maybe about 10 to 15 households. And so we asked them to just draw up a list of all the smokers within their area and just to collect some very basic data on them. Which I'll present in a bit, and that there were about 2,000 smokers in total within these 42 villages. And then we had these enrollment meetings at the community level, where about 215 smokers participated, so that's about 10%. We included 201 of them in our intervention. We had to drop 14, mainly because they didn't have an eligible partner, or they showed up to the meeting late, or various other issues. And then we randomly assigned these 201 smokers to a treatment group or the control group. At enrollment, we also provided counseling and education to everybody through a nurse. Then at enrollment, there was this deposit. And then for 10 weeks, they deposited with the community health worker. And then we had a follow-up at 3 months, at which time they were eligible to get the bonus and the deposits refunded or not, depending on the urine cotinine test. And then we did another follow-up at 6 months, where we had repeated the test. And that actually, we didn't really announce the specific date in advance, so it wasn't a complete surprise. They knew that they were going to be tested, but they didn't know exactly when. And so those are the results I'm going to focus on. And then we were planning on doing a 12-month follow-up, but as some of you might remember, there was severe flooding in Thailand back in, November a year ago. And so we weren't able to do the 12-month follow-up. So last month, I went back, and we ended up doing self-reported phone calls did phone calls to collect self-reported smoking status, and that's about the 13 to 16-month follow-up. And I don't actually have that data now, but it will be finalized very soon. And so jumping to the results, what am I doing on time? So here, this is just showing participation status. And as I said, we did this household survey of smokers within this area, and there were about 2,000 smokers in total. And only 30 villages out of the 42 ended up recruiting any smokers. And so part of the reason is that the community health workers within those villages either weren't engaged in the project or weren't really interested, or in some cases there weren't smokers available who were interested. However, at any rate, we only recruited from 30 of those villages. Most of these are men, and it's mostly middle-aged smokers who have smoked. In our sample, it's three decades that they've been smoking. So these are really long-term smokers who have been smoking for a long time. And so in that respect, it's not necessarily the easiest population to intervene on. That said, they are an older population who might be more motivated by improving their health, and so they might be interested in quitting. Most of them use hand-rolled tobacco, which is much cheaper in Thailand and is very common in rural areas of Thailand, and that does have an impact on what their tobacco expenditures are and possibly how interested they would be in, or the amount that they're willing to deposit. The big difference, though, is in terms of wanting to quit, and this gets back to the selection issue. So you notice that overall it's about 20% or 17% of smokers say that they want to quit, whereas in our sample it's 82%. Within the next 6 months. And so we did really end up recruiting the vast majority are interested in quitting, and so that's really the population that theoretically these commitment contracts would be most useful for. And so it's possible that we're have improved targeting using this approach that requires people to pay a little something up front. So looking at the balance of sociodemographic factors, in our sample, it's kind of similar to what the overall sample was. About 70% of the sample was Buddhist. These people have fairly low education levels. Only 30% of the treatment group and 19% of the control group have any secondary education. And monthly household income is fairly low as well. And there is fairly good balance along these dimensions. And here's the smoking characteristics. Similarly, there's fairly good balance. What to highlight? So among those who have, so we asked people to report among their five best friends how many of them all smoke, and about 50% in either group said that that all their best friends smoke. So obviously that gets at the social dimension. There are people embedded in social networks where a large number of people smoke. So I mentioned earlier that a hallmark perhaps of time inconsistency among smokers is that people have repeated quit attempts. And you can see here for our sample, only about 20% of these of our sample have never tried to quit in the past. Whereas on average, or the median rather, is two quit attempts. And there's several people, it's about 7% of the sample, have tried to quit 10 or more times. So these are people who have tried repeatedly and have not succeeded. And it does appear that many of these people have tried other methods or tried to quit on their own and not succeeded in quitting. So just focusing now on the use of the savings account. Basically, everybody deposited the amount at enrollment. We required $1.67 at enrollment, which is 50 baht. And all but two smokers were willing to do that. And then subsequently, most people did use the account to some extent. 85% deposited more than the minimum, However, only the median is only $7. That's much less than what we saw in the Philippine study. That's about 3% of median income. And whereas in the Philippine study, it was about 20%. And one possibility which we want to explore in the future is that by providing this cash incentive, in addition to the commitment contract, that it might have crowded out the motivation to deposit. Because if somebody needs to give some sort of, there's some threshold for a financial stake that they need to give in order to motivate themselves, perhaps if they have this bonus, they don't need to give money in their savings account because they already have some sort of financial motivation. So it's possible that these carrots and sticks are working as substitutes. At any rate, we're not exactly sure. It could be cultural differences, but that's something that we need to look at in the future. So looking at this by smoking status at 6 months, the top line refers to those who had quit at 6 months. The bottom line is those who were still smoking at 6 months. And you can see that the quitters were much more likely to deposit in their account, even starting from the first week. And so this is not a causal relationship. It's possible that people who had quit were more likely to deposit, but it's also possible that depositing was helping people to quit. It's hard to say. We're not able to really determine which direction the arrow goes. But this would be consistent, at least, with the idea that the deposits had some influence. And just to give you some participants' views on the depositing, we conducted some qualitative interviews with them to get their perspective on, because this was a pilot study, to see kind of what they thought of the intervention. So one of them said, "Depositing money totally changed my thoughts. It always urged me every time when a Village Health volunteer visited and collected the money. I wanted to quit smoking completely." So,
sorry, Justin. Can I ask to frame $1.67 one more time? How is it in relation, say, to a pouch of tobacco?
Okay, yes, that's a good question. So as I said, there's roll-your-own tobacco, or handmade tobacco, and there's manufactured tobacco. So manufactured tobacco, it's usually about $2. Whereas the hand-rolled tobacco, it's only about 5 baht. And so that would be, it's pretty expensive. Yeah, exactly. So in this setting, their tobacco expenditures are quite low for the treatment group, which I think does have a kind of big effect. And that's why if you were to kind of scale this elsewhere, it could have different consequences and might be actually more attractive to people because they might be spending more of their household earnings on tobacco. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Another smoker said, "When the project first gave advice about quitting smoking, I didn't think much about the money. But when I kept making deposits, I wanted to quit even more." So this person obviously didn't think about the money at first, but that changed. Someone else said, "Sometimes I forgot for a while that I needed to quit smoking. But when the collector came, that reminded me that I had to quit smoking. Depositing money didn't actually urge me that much. In general, it was like just to remind myself." And so it's important to recognize that this deposit collection is also functioning as a reminder for the person, oh yeah, I'm supposed to quit smoking. And so it's not necessarily just the money that could be having an effect. It's also the fact that they're being visited on a weekly basis. And there's also a social intervention built into this where somebody who is respected in the community is asking them about whether or not they're going to quit smoking. And so it's not necessarily always just the money. There's several things going on here. And this kind of gives you a range of there were varying views on the deposits, some positive, some negative, and this kind of demonstrates that. So looking at the overall results, this is what I presented at the beginning. Overall, at 6 months, about a third of the sample quit, 44% in the treatment group, and then 19% in the control group. And this is fairly large relative to other interventions, including kind of trials that look at nicotine replacement therapy and relative to other behavioral interventions like doctors providing counseling. This is a very large effect relative to those. And I should mention that relapse rates were fairly low, which is promising, at least between the 3 month and the 6 month mark. It was about 15% of smokers in the treatment group who relapsed. And so, as I said, that relapse after the incentives end is a big concern, and it'll be important to kind of look at the 14-month results that we just collected to see if more people have relapsed as well. So those were unadjusted. Then if we kind of run the regression results, you can see that controlling for various sociodemographics, the smoking characteristics, as well as different trial factors, that the average treatment effect, it varies between about 22 percentage points and 26 percentage points, but it does hold up fairly well. I don't know if you want to read all those controls, but I'm happy to pause if you want. So it was a fairly large range of things that we could control for.
So I see you controlled for having a pre-selected teammate within the treatment group. Did that matter to people with?
So I'm actually going to get back to that I'll hold that for a little bit. I'm going to discuss that.
And as I recall, education was a pretty big difference between the control and treatment.
It's true. So.
I
actually omitted education because it was very highly collinear with age. I think that's a cohort issue. And so it was like a correlation of, it was over 0.5. And so for that reason, I omitted from this relationship. But I did run it with education in there, and the coefficient size were pretty much the same, at least on the treatment effect. Okay, so looking at the team outcomes, so overall about 27% of people of participants that's in the treatment group earn the bonus. So one question is, well, are these just random people who happen to quit together, or was there actually some sort of social component to that? And so one way you can get that is to look at what the concordance is between teammates' smoking status. And so you can see that there is a difference between the control. So I should say, in the control group, I forgot to mention this earlier, we actually did assign partners to those people in the control group, but we never announced who their partners were. So we have these kind of synthetic partners that we can use in our analysis, but we didn't actually tell them, and I was the only one who actually knew based on my kind of randomization procedure. And so we can use that. And so those people, the synthetic partners, are included in this control column, as well as those who pre-selected their partners. I didn't break it out here. But at any rate, there is a difference. And so clearly, those in the treatment group are more likely to cluster in terms of quitting. Here, at least, there's not a clustering in terms of both smoking. There's also a concern that people are going to have a discouragement effect, like, oh, you see your partner fails, therefore you're going to be more likely to fail, at least in this kind of very kind of crude cut, there doesn't appear to be that clustering among both of them failing together. So then we can look at what some of the predictors of this concordance are. So in this first model with all the teams, so you can see that the treatment effect kind of holds up about the same as we saw in the last slide. But then we also can look at the pre-selected teams. And you would think that if people are pre-selecting their teams, they're going to be more likely to succeed, perhaps because they're going to pick somebody who they trust, somebody who they're close friends with, somebody who can monitor them more closely. So there's a lot of reasons to think that the pre-selected partners would help. It turns out that it didn't. It actually, these are only modestly significant in that among the quit column. But at least among the quit column, it appears that, these are marginal effects from multinomial logit models, that having a pre-selected teammate actually hurt your chances of quitting. And so one possible reason is that these teammates are enabling each other. Maybe if you pre-selected a good friend that you're going to smoke together, you're like, I saw my partner smoking yesterday, I'm going to be more likely to smoke with that person. At any rate, this is something that I think with our data we actually might be able to look at a bit more carefully, but so far I just have kind of the results from this regression. So also, if you restrict the sample to those who are randomly assigned to a partner and to those in the treatment group, you can look at both physical distance among partners' houses and social distance in terms of kind of what your pre-existing relationship was to your partner before the intervention. And here again, you see very counterintuitive results, which I don't really understand. But it's showing that if you are farther, you live farther from your So in terms of distance, if you live farther from your partner, you're going to be more likely to both end up in the smoke category. So that actually is somewhat intuitive. But relative to the second category, so I coded a dummy variable about whether your partner was a close friend or a family member versus other. And so here, a close friend or family member, again, led to less likely to be able to quit. And this could be the enabling aspect or some other factor, or it could be, we're getting down to small sample sizes, so it's hard to exactly say for sure, but this is something that I hope to look at a lot more later. Okay, so we also collected data on people's social interactions with their partner to see it to the extent that that mattered. And this is just, just some summary statistics, but it is something that we're going to look at a little bit more carefully. I haven't quite gotten to this part of the analysis yet. But just looking at the frequency with which pairs talked, so there's a fairly large chunk of people who never saw their partner. Despite living in the same village, there was 15% of people who just never saw their partner, and another 10% who only saw them monthly, so maybe three times in between the enrollment and the three-month follow-up. But there also were a majority who did see their partner on a weekly or more basis. And if you recode this variable, the frequency with which you talk to your partners about quitting as kind of weekly or more versus other, there is a bit of a difference between quitting the quitters at 6 months and the smokers at 6 months. And again, that's not causal because maybe you avoided your partner because you failed to quit or something like that. But at any rate, that's one thing. And then also we asked about whether your teammate advised you, and we have other data on kind of what the nature of that relationship was. And it does appear that there's some differences again between whether you advised your teammate or whether your teammate advised you during the time period. And that did appear to at least be correlated with quitting. So again, some participants' views on the team bonus. One says, I like team competition because I would procrastinate if I had to quit all by myself. I would wait and never think that I'll actually do it today. This time was like many other times that I told myself and failed. I succeeded this time because I said that it must be today. So this is a budding behavioral economist, of course. Another says, I thought about the bonus all the time because I knew that I could definitely quit. This also made me talk to my partner more because both of us would get the bonus if we succeeded. We tempted each other using this bonus. Another says, my partner and I rarely talked. It would be better if my partner was somebody who's closer to me because I dare talk to him more. But this could also affect me if I couldn't quit, but my partner could, and I knew I'd drag my partner down. He wouldn't get the bonus because of me. And so this gets at, first of all, that this person didn't actually talk to their partner very often, but also the aspect that guilt could play a role in this. The final results from that I'm going to show today. So I did some back of the envelope calculations on cost per quitter. And so you can just focus on the red data series that shows adjusting for purchasing power. Cost per quitter in my team commitment intervention was $450 about per quitter. This includes all study costs except for those related to the survey design. And we also don't include the cost to the smoker themselves. For instance, if they purchased gum or something on their own to help with their quit attempt, that's not included in this. I'd argue that if I were to do this study again exactly the same, I think I could easily do it without affecting the effectiveness, and I could do it for 33% cheaper and do it for $300 per quitter. Just simply by, first of all, if we purchased the urine test strips locally, I wasn't aware at the time that the trial started that those were available, those were a lot cheaper if I bought locally, etc. That I think it would be very easy to do for less. And then in the middle column, you see the Philippines care study, that's where they just had a basic commitment contract. And there it was $700 per quitter. So there's differences there in terms of, so first of all, there's differences in purchasing, personnel costs between the Philippines and Thailand. But also there's a difference between the effectiveness of my intervention and this CARES intervention. And that appears to be what's playing the biggest role in terms of our intervention being a bit cheaper. And then the last two columns look at nicotine gum and then one of the prescription drugs, the most common that's prescribed in Thailand. And these data are based on cost and effectiveness parameters from Thailand that I then converted to US dollars. And you can see that nicotine gum and varenicline are much more expensive to provide. And this doesn't even account for the personnel costs of if you're providing counseling to somebody who's going to be using the prescription drugs or administering them. And so this is just simply providing the drugs themselves. And the gains that from quitting are substantially outweigh these. So pretty much in any calculation you want to think about, this is a fairly cost-effective intervention, as well as perhaps a cost-beneficial intervention. And I will be refining these estimates in the coming weeks, but kind of just a back-of-the-envelope cost suggests that this was a fairly affordable intervention relative to others out there. So let me just wrap up quickly. So 10% of the area smokers signed up for this this intervention. That's comparable to elsewhere or other studies. And, you know, 10% signed up, about half in the treatment group quit. That's 5% of all smokers. And that's, if you're thinking about a reduction in smoking rates of 5% in any village, you can actually start to think about a social multiplier going on, potential social spillovers with that many people. And so that's one area where there could be potential, and something that I'd like to try to measure in the future. I think I covered the others. I'll just say that some next steps are, first of all, I want to study a bit more on kind of what team characteristics promoted quitting. I have a lot of data that I didn't present. You can look at things like how closely relate, the age differences among partners in Thailand, especially. It's very hierarchical. Maybe if you were with a partner who's of a similar age, that would help. As well as one unique thing that we have is we have data on subjective expectations of quitting, both for yourself and for all other participants from your village. And so we can look at the role that these predictions are going to have on people quitting, and there's some theory that backs this up that we're going to try to test. As well as to see how well people are predicting, whether people are mispredicting what their chances are of succeeding. And we can also use that to try to get at some sort of causal estimate of what the effect is of your partner quitting on your own quit status. And so I think that this is something that should be tested in other contexts, other rural areas, potentially in work sites or clinics. And I think this is, you know, just a pilot, but it does have some potential, and I think it does merit at least further study. So with that, I'll end. Thank you.
Yes. So Justin, is the prospect of two rewards change the meaning of the middle one? So, you know, you're attributing the differential quit rates to the team aspect of it, but I thought I detected a little bit in that little quote there a sense that the intervening reward didn't mean much to, you know, collecting my own savings back was less of an incentive than it would have been if it's the only incentive out there. And there's this psychology on sort of differences of reward structures and the presence of a middle, you know, sort of a booby prize, that people discount that more, even if you don't change the balance. So there's this study I lost the detail on it, but basically, where set some reward at some dollar amount or whatever amount, and then if you put something on top of it, suddenly that middle category gets demotivated. Mm-hmm. And so is there a risk that this team bonus is in fact countering itself just a little, countering the individual incentive just a little bit?
Yes, I think that is a risk. The bottom line is I don't think I can say for sure. First of all, by adding this extra component, you're complicating the intervention for, this is a rural, fairly low education population, and it gets kind of confusing when you're talking about adding these different layers. So just in terms of confusion, that can perhaps dilute the impact. On top of that, I sort of made mention to the fact that there could be this substitutability between the different incentives, and that they could be, perhaps we're just wasting money by adding this extra layer on top of it. And it's something that I think we have in mind that we want to actually kind of cleanly measure this in the future to try to understand it. But with this data, I'm not able to say per se what the relative impact was, or at least not at this point.
I wonder what counts as a gain to quitting, and you get a figure of $3,500 or something from the U.S. And I also connected to that question
It seems to me there are two kinds of costs of the program, and one is a real resource cost from hiring people and buying strips or whatever. But the other is the cost of providing incentives, like this team bonus. Mm-hmm. And that, depending on exactly what you're trying to count, you might not want to count that as a cost, because it's going to lead to increased utility, and people who receive it are going to be, you know, benefiting, and so on. And in a way, the first one is a, you know, it's a social cost, it's a real resource cost, and the second is just a sort of redistribution that, from the point of view of what it costs to mount a program, mm-hmm. that's what you want. But from the point of view of some sort of broader evaluation of the effectiveness relative to cost of these programs, you might want to distinguish those, it seems to me.
I didn't do a good job of explaining that estimate on the cost that you gain from quitting. That comes from the CDC. That's like their official numbers. It includes like productivity costs, the excess costs of mortality, so healthcare costs, and I think it's specifically public costs that they were looking at. This is supposed to be an estimate of the social cost. And then they look
in
at
the U.S.
In the U.S. That was a number from the U.S. I couldn't find something comparable for Thailand. It may exist, but I haven't seen it. And then it was also including infant mortality costs.
Because we also have
infant healthcare costs.
RAND study, which very plausibly says, oh, they're great gains to having smokers die young and yes. not have.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a contentious area. I think in terms of saving on pensions and that sort of thing, that data was also very old. And I've seen various estimates. And I think by most of them, this would still be considered to be cost-effective, or mm-hmm. perhaps that cost-benefit comparison, rather. So getting to your point about kind of because there is a utility gain to the cost of the intervention, I guess I would say that there's also an offsetting utility loss, perhaps because if you're worried about kind of the guilt that you're imposing on these people, or the social pressure aspect is actually imposing some sort of cost on the smokers as well. Mm-hmm. And that's something I'm not trying to capture at all. This is supposed to be kind of just in terms of resource costs. But I think it's something that you certainly could model and potentially try to measure in a careful way, or at least try to understand a bit better. But it's not something that we detected, kind of picked up in this study. But it is worth giving more thought to.
So my comment was, I sort of lost the distinction between the control and the treatment, so maybe after we through all those various things, you get a little summary when you present it next. But I was thinking about the effect of the team support, and I saw two possible drivers of that. One would be the cost would be maybe shaming or embarrassing one for blowing it, mm-hmm. And the other one would be the reciprocity of succeeding and of getting the payments and that financial benefit as well as the benefit of stopping smoking. And that has an effect on the design of the program, whether or not you're emphasizing that camaraderie-ness of having people support each other versus the awareness of the financial gains and the gains of smoking. So, are you able to play with those two different motivations?
So, for example, we did ask some questions around, did your partners, first of all, do you know if your partner quit? Second, do you know, did that person quit, do you know if that person quit or failed to quit before you? And then we asked kind of if that either quit or failure to quit had any impact on you. The problem is we're getting down to like very small numbers, and so we don't actually, I don't think we're able to directly say much about it.
I think
in terms of how we pitched it, it was kind of a balance between, we mostly talked, framed the intervention in terms of social support, but built it. I think just by the very nature of the design, there is this pressure aspect to it. It's something that we aren't able to very clearly distinguish, I think.
So I'll just say that we have an R01, which is and it'll be reviewed next week to do a larger version of this, and we are envisioning multiple different cells that one could analyze. So one could separate out the group team effect of the social support as one arm without any extra incentives versus the social support with the team bonus. And so, you know, one could envision it a version of this that would test between those. And it wasn't done here. It's a small sample, small budget. But just to add to that, any ideas that you have would be very relevant to us right now. Obviously, if we get funded, we're going to be designing something very quickly at a final version of this. And if we don't get funded, we're going back in. So we would love to hear all of the comments.
Okay, I think we'd better stop. Thank you very much.